This is a snapshot of where we are, right? This is our second Sunday looking at this section where he's described the incarnation and what it entails and what it involved, some of its effects, and now he turns to answer objections. And along the way, he's offered a few objections that he anticipates, and he's argued against them, but now he turns to two specific groups. And in this section, he turns to the objections of the Jews and addresses them beautifully, I think. We'll see if you agree. And then in a moment, after this section, he's going to turn and address the objections of the Gentiles. So in this section, because he's addressing the arguments of the Jews, and less dealing with their arguments, although he does, and more dealing with why they should believe, he turns to the Scriptures. So we saw that some last week, but he begins this section by pointing out that they read the same Scriptures we do to understand who the Messiah would be and what his ministry would look like and what the effects of that ministry should be, especially on the Gentile nations. And then he turns and says, and look what Christ has done. Look at all of this that has been accomplished by the God Word, and even the Jews themselves admit, right, that these things have not happened at any other time or at any other moment in history. And then he quotes Moses from Deuteronomy at a couple of points, which we talked about last week, right? I'll look up the particular language of it, right? But life hanging before their eyes, but they refuse to believe. Let's see. That's from Deuteronomy 28:66. You will see your life hanging before your eyes, right? And talking about their stubbornness and their persistence in unbelief. The things that he talks about in this passage seem to come down to four things. One is prophecy, right? The level of detail in the Old Testament Scriptures describing the expectation about who this one would be, that he's not merely human, but also divine. The nature of his coming, and he points to the language of one of the verses in Isaiah 53, talking about this servant, who can declare his generation, and uses the Greek in particular to talk about that's talking about the virgin birth here. Right, because his origin, his birth, his genesis is inscrutable, because he comes from a woman without the help of a man. Right, he talks about how the Old Testament speaks in detail about the nature of his death. Again, the passage from Deuteronomy: "You will see your life hanging before your eyes." He talks about the effect, and this gets into one of the later themes, but the effect that his ministry would have on the Gentiles. So he deals in close detail with Old Testament prophecy at multiple points. In that, he turns to discuss the fulfillment, right? It's not just that the prophecy has discussed these things in detail, but all of these things have been fulfilled in the God Word, in his ministry, in his life, in the incarnation as a whole, from before his coming to after his death. He talks about the coming of the Magi, right? And they would have left the East before he's actually born. And they bring tribute so that he is then a king of Israel and Judah who has spoiled his enemies and has trophies of victory from them as an infant. And what other king had that? He even talks about Josiah beginning his reign at 7 or 8, and yet even so, he didn't have these trophies of victory before he's able to call his mother and father by name, right? So that all of these expectations of what Messiah would be and what his ministry would look like, they reach their fulfillment in the incarnation, and he talks about that in detail. But then he also points to cessation, right? Because all of these things have found their fulfillment in Christ, Jerusalem no longer stands. Right? The holy city has been destroyed by the Romans. He's pointing back to AD 70 so that the temple is gone. Prophecy is gone. Sacrifice is gone. The throne of the Son of David is gone because the Son of David is reigning from heaven, right? But all of these things that they attached their hope to have ceased. Not because the promise is off, not because it's been broken, but because it's been fulfilled. And then something he keeps coming back to is the promise that this one would turn the Gentiles, that you would have the nations bringing tribute and homage to this Son of David, which you see fulfilled in the incarnation. And then he heaps shame, as it were, on the Jews by pointing out that through this one, through the incarnation of the God Word, right, you have pagans turning to worship the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And how else could this be? What else could possibly bring this about except that what they expect and what they say they are still looking for has already come to pass? And he speaks of a willful blindness in their refusal to acknowledge that and turn. So remember about the context, although there's an ongoing dialogue between the Christians and the Jews at this point in early church history, there have also been famous incidents of Gentiles who become Christians and then later convert to Judaism. So he's addressing Christian believers to strengthen their faith, assuming that there will be Jews who also read over their shoulder and see what he has to say, as it were. But he's also bolstering the faith and strengthening their resolve to remain true to Christ for fear that there might be some who could be persuaded to convert to Judaism as well, because that was a real thing in the time that he's writing. But that's this section in a nutshell. There's so much more we could say in the detail, and I know that, you know, it often happens that we feel like we've said all there is to say about a passage, and then someone will ask a question, or we'll start to read a section, and then the floodgates open. But I'm curious what things you've observed, or what questions this gives rise to as we look at this section. The next section, which will take 2 weeks to do, is his turning then to address the Gentiles. And so he gets into philosophy in particular. And it's a beautiful section also. But in this section, as he's addressing the Jews, what questions do we have, observations we've made? Jody. Yeah, so what's the other side of this? So there are some famous, there's a dialogue with Trypho, is one, I don't remember if that's Justin or Tertullian, where I think you actually get both sides of the conversation. That would have been a couple of generations before. And similarly, you get dialogue with pagan philosophers as well, which will come in the next section. Most of what we have is not their objections. Most of what we have are the Christians answering them. And so sometimes they'll include the objections as they go through it. Often not, though. So a brief summary, I think they would say, as we see some in the New Testament, they expect the physical reign of a Son of David from a throne in Jerusalem. And so we don't have that. And so we're still looking for this one to come. That feeds into a lot of the politics of the time, going as far back as the Maccabees and as late as Bar Kokhba in the 130s, right? They keep looking for a military and political figure to rise up and throw off the yoke of whichever powerful nation seems to be in control of the Levant at the time. So with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids going back and forth and the Romans coming in and kind of busting them up, right, they have this breathing space during the time of the Maccabees. And so you have Judas Maccabeus rise up, and there's this flash of independence for Judah until the Romans come in and squash everything, right? And that's about 200 years before Christ and in that window. And then you have witness even in the New Testament to these revolts that have been happening, and so they wonder if Jesus is one of these figures. He's asked, Paul is asked, are you then the Egyptian, right? When in conversation he knows Greek, and that's referring to one of these leaders of a revolt. But there does seem to be an expectation that the coming of this one we expect involves all of the passages that talk about vengeance for God's people in the prophets, and none of the passages that involve a reign of peace and the inclusion of the Gentiles. So obviously that's an oversimplification, but that does seem to be a key feature of what they expected.
It's kind of like a continuation of their myopic understanding of God's word. You know, the idea that you could be looking at the Gentiles too for inclusion. Yeah, they just stuff.
Part of it too is there's a complexity in their expectation. Is there going to be one Messiah? Are there going to be two? Right? Are we going to have both a priestly Messiah and a kingly, a royal Messiah? And is that going to be accompanied by a rise in prophecy? So this rubric that we use of prophet, priest, and king, right, we know that Calvin develops it, but it's actually very ancient. So Josephus writes about the Maccabees in terms of that rubric of expectation, prophet, priest, and king. And so part of the question is, are they expecting one figure or two or possibly three? Which is one thing that I find compelling, actually, about the New Testament portrait of Jesus, is that in one person who is also God coming to his people, this expectation of three offices are fulfilled in one person. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the richness of that imagery, mm-hmm, in the Messiah.
Yeah.
The place where God meets his people.
And to develop that a little bit, this identification of Jesus with the Holy of Holies.
It's really powerful.
It is. If you trace that out in terms of biblical theology, right? What is the Holy of Holies? What's significant about it? What can you all tell me about the Holy of Holies? Only priests are allowed within the Holy of Holies. Where is the Holy of Holies? It's in the temple. It's separated from the rest of the temple, right, by a screen.
God's presence
dwells there above the mercy seat, right, Tony? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and just as the veil is torn, so Christ's body is torn to open up that access. Yeah. Yeah. Which also picks up on similar themes in Hebrews, where Jesus is both the priest and the offering. So, what can you tell me about the shape of the Holy of Holies? So we get this in a description of Solomon's temple and the architecture of Solomon's temple. Let me see if I can find the passage. It would be in 1 Kings. So, chapter 6, I think. Here we go. Yeah, chapter 6. So if you look at verse 19. Well, this is the inner sanctuary. So it's here in this passage, the shape of the Holy of Holies in the temple. And so likely also in the tabernacle, but definitely in Solomon's temple. Is a perfect cube. Where else do we see a perfect cube?
In the new
heavens and new earth, right? So there's no temple in the New Jerusalem, but the dimensions of the New Jerusalem are a perfect cube, right? Which harkens back to the temple, which is decorated with all of this garden imagery, right? So it links back to the temple, but also links back to Eden, right? So that the Holy of Holies is a mini garden, which at the end of Revelation becomes a garden city, which is not a temple, but is a specific part of the temple writ large, and is the place where God dwells with his people. Where they are in his presence without the intervention of a human priesthood, although our high priest Christ is there. Yeah. It's a beautiful development. And so Athanasius ties into that. He doesn't develop that in full. But in talking about Jesus, yeah. And that ties into his argument that all of the things that the Jews attach importance to have ceased, right? Jerusalem no longer stands. The Holy of Holies is no longer there. Prophecy has ceased. But the reason is not because these things are empty. The reason is because the reality has come, right? And he picks up on this Pauline argument. The reality is here, and so there's no longer a need for the shadow. It's not that God's promises to the Jews are written off. It's that they've come to fulfillment in the incarnation of the God Word. So that all of this expectation that they have is not, cessation's almost the wrong word, right? It's been fulfilled and continues to exist in Christ. Jerusalem is rubble. The temple is destroyed. There is no longer sacrifice. We don't have prophets arising because the truth has come.
I think you said you don't need shadow when you have
faith. Yeah. The truth is here. We have no need for the shadow. So. Yeah. I mean, I find that compelling. I would love to have... surely this would have generated some correspondence. I would love to see the reaction and the dialogue that would have come from these kinds of discussions.
I think that may be part of what glory is. Is understanding those dialogues and points of view.
And it's after he lays this out that he comes back and points out that we also have, as a result of this, right? And shame on you for not believing. The Gentiles are turning. Pagans are turning to the God of Isaac and Abraham and Jacob. So, It's almost as though he's saying, look, the Gentiles get it. You have the scriptures. You know these passages. You know what they teach. You know what I'm telling you, although you refuse to admit its import, right? But the Gentiles get it. They do, yeah. Yeah. Which he points them to. Yeah. Yeah. This is nothing other than, right? Even your refusal to submit to Christ, that too is described by the prophecies to which you look. So much here. What other questions and observations do we have? One thing he points to, we talked about this a little bit last week, are Jesus' miracles. Right? Jesus raised people from the dead, but as the Jews themselves point out, that happened during Elijah and Elisha's ministry. It seems counterintuitive, but Athanasius seems to be saying that's the least impressive of the things that Jesus has done. Because we've seen that before. But what do we see in the ministry of Jesus? Well, we see what the prophets told us to. You'll remember the word that gets back to John the Baptist from Jesus, right? Are you the one to whom we should look? Or should we look for another, right? And it's the lame walk, the deaf hear, the blind see, right? And the dumb speak. And Athanasius is able to say as he develops his argument, yes, we've seen people raised from the dead before, but where have we seen these things? Only in the incarnation. Right? Only in the ministry of God the Word. Right? As you yourselves say. And then he points back to John 9. Where in the discussion with the man who was born blind and is now able to see, it comes up, right? How can this happen unless he is sent from God? We've never seen this before. With that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Which is, I love what John does with the way he tells that. The whole chapter, and it's a long chapter, but the whole chapter is like this running pun on the blindness of the Jewish leaders in the face of the clear sight of the one who was born blind.
Well, so, one of the great ironies in that chapter 9 of John is, isn't this during the Festival of the Lights? They're celebrating the presence of God. They want to excommunicate the guy for being healed.
And I love how his parents extricate themselves from the predicament, right? They bring his parents in, like, hey, what happened? And they're like, he's old enough, ask him. But I love how that passage ends, right? Yeah, do you also want to believe? And then at the very end of the chapter, right, as though they have to seal it, right, in case you didn't get what John is on about, right? Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. And it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." And just to put the seal on what has just happened, right? Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains." And I think it's not, by accident that Athanasius continues to bring in this passage that ends in that way. Right? There's all of this that you know, that you can see, that you can consider, and yet you do as the prophet said you would. Right? You refuse to believe. Say all the while saying that you can see. And what position does that put you in? The Gentiles, who could be described as blind in this way, right? They have come to see God the Word. And they are turning to Him in droves. But you who have the Scriptures, you who have these prophecies, you who know the expectations and can say, "Yes, in the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, we have seen some of these things that we never saw at any other time. But because you say we see, your guilt remains." So it's a beautiful demonstration from the Old Testament, both on the level of intricate detail of individual passages, but also the sweeping expectations and that biblical theological buildup of what it is that He will do when He comes and who it is that is coming. Right? And they have all of this. So there's both Athanasius's summary and synthesis of all of this information, but there's also this back and forth that you know this, you have this, you believe this, but you refuse to submit to what you know has come to pass. So, and that, I think, is both the addressing those he knows is reading over the shoulder of the believers he's writing to, and also a powerful argument to hold the attention and bolster the faith of those who might be tempted to convert to Judaism. So. Jody. I was wondering about that this morning. Like, it seems to us that being raised from the dead is rather more impressive. And maybe that's something about my understanding is maybe faulty here, right? But this seems to be something Athanasius has in common with those he's arguing against, that we don't, right? So why is it that in the Old Testament we have this being raised from the dead, but we don't have the blind see and the lame walk and the dumb speak, right? And so why does that seem to carry more weight, both in the expectation of what the coming of Messiah will look like and then in the earthly ministry of Jesus? And I don't know. Yeah. 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 So part of it is expectation, like what's built into the prophecies, what are they told to look for? I have another thought, but John, you have a hand.
Well,
yeah.
I can understand what Tony said. I'm not sure I understand Jody's question, but I think I understood what you said. But I think the part of the answer is that you're never quite certain that somebody's dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part of it may relate to this uncertainty, right? Is someone really truly dead yet? There have been recent headlines actually about whether brain dead is actually a valid consideration. Is that a true indication, a lack of brain activity that someone has actually passed? I've seen that within the last few weeks. You may be aware that in some archaeological excavations in Europe in particular, so medieval graveyards, they have found marks on the inside of coffins where it turns out people they thought were dead and they buried woke up and tried to escape and were unable to. So part of it may be, sorry, it's a bit morbid, but do we know, right? Do we know if someone is truly dead? And thinking about the people who are raised to life in the Old Testament, right? If I remember correctly, they're people who have immediately expired. Whereas even if you think about the ministry of Jesus, right, he waits. He waits. He knows that Lazarus is going to die and he waits. He waits so long that when he comes and wants to go to the tomb, right, one of Lazarus' sisters tells him, Lord, by now there will be an odor. So I think that's part of it. And then also, John, as you mentioned, with someone who's born blind, right, there's not uncertainty. The people around him, their family, their friends, they know, they've always known this person is blind. They've never been able to see. It's been years. And then to tie back into something Athanasius discusses earlier with the incarnation, Jesus' lordship over these things, over the effects of corruption in creation, show him to be the creator. Because he's not just able to revive someone who may be dead or may be fainted. Right? He is able to recreate in the work that he does. He is able to take something faulty about someone's creation, as it were, that they've lacked sight from the moment they were born, and is able to recreate sight in that person. So that he is showing his power as creator, and then from his argument from what is appropriate or what is fitting, right? It is because he is creator that it is so appropriate that he is the one who recreates, right? It is because he is life itself that it is so appropriate and so fitting that he raises the dead, he defeats death, and he brings new life to us. So, John.
Perhaps, well, it's important to remember too that in God's providence, that's why Christ was speared and water and blood came out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's There's no lack of certainty about his death. Well, this is something Athanasius discussed earlier, right? And he offers an argument against what has been called the swoon theory, right? That has been current in the last 50 or 100 years. This idea that, yeah, things were really terrible, but Jesus actually just fainted, essentially. And then somehow, having fainted because of all of that experience and that loss of blood and that suffering, and despite being able to trick the trained and skilled and experienced executioners, right, who come by to break his legs so that he'll suffocate and finish off because of the Sabbath, right? And they don't break his legs because he's already dead, right? He's somehow able to pull the wool over all of these people's eyes, gets laid in the tomb, and then after going through all of this, he's somehow able to pick himself back up and roll the stone away and walk out of there and be just as good as he was a week before. And Athanasius is familiar with this possibility and says this is why 3 days, right? When he's talking about the manner of Christ's death and why this way and not another and why so long and why a death that is so public and so ignominious. And that's one of the things he says, so that no one can, despite the fact that people have, so that no one can credibly come back and say, why wasn't it immediate? You know, he died and then he's back. Well, it's so that no one can say he wasn't really dead. So, even though some people have.
Mm-hmm. Over and over and over again, it's a common toy. And I saw something this week in a picture where a guy, everybody thought a guy was dead and he wasn't at all.
This is how the hero wins in some of the westerns,
right?
The bad guys think they finished him off, and it's just not worth the extra bullet to put one in his head, right?
Yeah,
so they get back on their horses and ride away, and then the next day he catches up to him. And,
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it ties back into the prophet's description of the Israelites and the Judeans' unwillingness to hear what God is saying to them through the prophets, because the imagery used to describe them is not of one who's born blind or born deaf, but of a willful stopping of their ears and closing of their eyes. You're right, I think there's something to the way the miracles Jesus does speak to that.
In John, he claims to be the light of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to the festival of the lights in Jerusalem, celebrating the presence of God with his people in the wilderness, and gives sight to this man who was born blind.
Mm-hmm. And I keep going back to the way John sets that up in the prologue, that Jesus is the light who comes into the world, right? And then there's this line about the darkness could not or did not, and then there's this purposeful double entendre there in John. I think it's 1:6, 1:5 or 1:6. where this word means both, could not comprehend and did not overcome. So that in this phrase, and John is one, right, sometimes when you're reading the scriptures in Greek or Hebrew, you run across a word that has multiple meanings. Usually it's being used in a particular way, right? And you get a sense of that by the passage and what the passage is talking about and how an author uses a word, right? And some of those uses are rather less likely in the context. But John and some of the other authors will often make word plays that are deliberate. And that's one that I think John does that's very purposeful, because as you trace the development of this theme of light and darkness across his gospel, right? And you see it with Nicodemus in chapter 3, right? Nicodemus, as a member of the ruling council, doesn't understand. And there's so much about the setup that brings you to this. He comes to Jesus in the dark and struggles to understand. But you also have from the very beginning, and I think this is part of why John puts the temple cleansing in chapter 2. And I know that there are many people who think that there are two temple cleansings. There's one at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and there's one in the final week, in the Passion Week. That may be. I don't think it is. I think Mike thinks it is. So you have, even in the congregation, two people who think differently about this. There we go. But I think the reason John puts that so early is because it highlights not just the lack of understanding, but the willful attempt on the part of darkness to suppress and overcome the light. So, which continues at the time Athanasius is writing. Right? He says, you know these things, you admit that these things are true, but you refuse to submit to the conclusions that you should draw from that. So, we're well over time. It's 10:08, so we should go. But.